injury lawyers Mike Riley and John Walsh.
When you hire a lawyer to help you with your personal injury, you want to know that you'll have that lawyer's personal attention. With John and I, that's exactly what you'll get. With many firms, the lawyer that you see in the ad is not the lawyer who is going to be representing you in the case.
One of the differences with Mike and my practice is that when you hire us, you'll have us personally involved in your case.
Call injury lawyers Mike Riley and John Walsh at 257-5661 for the personal attention you deserve.
Take the scenic drive to the Guitar Oasis Cool in Jefferson County. Jeff's Guitar Clinic, jeffsguitar.com.
Welcome to another podcast at SlysOffice.com, brought to you by the United Steelworkers and great local sponsors like Madison Computer Works and our friends at the Axley Law Firm. Joining us now, he is with the Milwaukee Area Service and Hospitality Workers Organization. That's a long one. You need to come up with some sort of acronym for that. Peter Rickman. Peter, good to have you on the show.
Thanks for having me on, as always, Sly.
Well, why don't
For what it's worth, we do have an acronym. It's MASH.
Oh, well, there you go. What is the Milwaukee Area Service and Hospitality Workers Organization?
Funny you should ask, Sly.
It's hilarious that I should ask.
Yeah. Well, MASH is it's a mashup of a labor organization, a hiring hall, a workforce development service provider, a worker center. We are the hub for workers in the service and hospitality industry who want good family-supporting jobs with career pathways, and we're the hub for employers in these industries that want access to a quality workforce. We launched just last week, 1 week ago today, to implement the landmark community benefits agreement covering the Bucks Arena and surrounding development, 15th of the Union, first source hiring requirements, a hiring hall obligation for the service and hospitality employers.
Yes, you forced...
And we launched...
go ahead. You forced the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel to write something about workers. That's not easy.
Well, and something positive.
I mean, right.
No, it wasn't a piece blaming workers for some alleged skills gap.
Very good. Okay, go ahead. I'm sorry.
An important distinction there.
Yes, I know.
We also launched MASH not just to implement the Bucks agreement, but to make it the rule as opposed to the exception. You know, the Bucks deserve a ton of credit for being leaders where people are pointing to them saying, well, that's really amazing. They've done something fantastic here. But if that's the exception as opposed to the example, we're not actually going to transform a city that badly needs it, nor are we going to build a model for how to turn the jobs that exist today and will exist tomorrow into good family-supporting jobs. So we launched MASH to expand the coverage of this Bucks-style agreement for 15 in the union and workforce development and a hiring hall. In fact, just on Monday, we announced an initiative to expand the coverage of this kind of agreement to the airport food service and retail workers in Milwaukee. You know, the jobs that will exist tomorrow in the arena and the surrounding development in food service and retail exist today in airport.
And this is with Supervisor Marcellia Nicholson.
Yeah, County Supervisor Marcellia Nicholson, who happens to be just a true champion of labor and working people. We worked with her, let's call it a year and a half ago or so.
Would you say she's stronger than Joe Lieberman?
I think in a head-to-head matchup, Supervisor Nicholson would come out on
okay.
top.
All right.
But I'd also say that comparing her to many, many politicians today.
There's a woodchuck in my backyard that probably would do better on that. I'm just looking out my back window here.
Oh, well, I mean, I can only imagine the wildlife around your house. They're probably all, you know, worker-oriented lefties.
Absolutely. They do not come on my property unless they check off yes on union. You bet.
And they don't chuck wood for anything less than $15 an hour.
That's right.
I mean, this is union skill woodchucking.
Oh, I'm sorry. We digress. All right, so go ahead.
Well, we launched this campaign with Supervisor Nicholson, who happens to have been the person that's led the fight for a $15 an hour wage floor for contracted service workers in Milwaukee here a year and a half ago or so. You know, I think that part of our work here is to build this community standard around wage floors at a living wage and above. around and rebuild the power of working people to bargain up wages and economic standards, while also addressing the business models in the service and hospitality industry that have driven standards down so far and necessitate this organization to actually change things. I mean, this is crazy to me, Sly, that, you know, it takes a separate organization to address the needs of employers. If your service or hospitality industry employer, there's basically one business model, but you're taking it in the shorts for 20% of your labor costs. What business continues to pay 20% higher costs on anything? Well, it's the one that can't figure out how to do it differently. And that's not because there aren't smart business owners in the service and hospitality industries, but they're disincented from doing anything to address the way that workforce issues negatively impact their businesses. You know, the 20% premium that service and hospitality industry employers in high turnover and low productivity could easily be traded for decent employment standards, and these employers would benefit not only from a quality workforce on the front end, but, you know, over the life cycle of employing people, have folks who, you know, bring knowledge and experience and commitment to the industry. So part of what we're doing is not just fighting for higher standards for workers. We are working with employers to work with a different model and bring real returns to their business in terms of a quality workforce. And we think that's part of how we can change the entire service and hospitality sectors. And that, in fact, Sly, is our view of how we think we can change a whole community like Milwaukee and change employment in these large and growing sectors of where there are a lot of bad jobs.
Peter Rickman with us, Milwaukee Area Service Hospitality Workers Organization. MASH, I guess, is what you call it. But I also want to know how Wisconsin's recently passed so-called right-to-work law, how much that's added to the hurdle in what you're trying to accomplish.
Well, you know, I think part of what, you know, slide necessity is the mother of invention. And we live in an era where a labor law that was written in 1935 and amended in 1947 and 1954, but not to expand the rights of workers or to change the relationship that workers have with employers, that simply isn't going to cut it anymore when it comes to bargaining up standards or building worker power. And so the right-to-work laws that were adopted in states in, you know, the last couple of years, including obviously here in Wisconsin, have just simply calcified this utterly broken labor law system that we have. You know, this is, and if you give me just a sec to digress,
sure.
I think
I can
really better answer the question here by putting in some context. This is the first time in American history, the first time in the country that birthed the middle class, and that is still the richest country in the world, but just tremendously unequal because of the power in the hands of bosses and the 1%. This is the first time in American history where a so-called full employment economy, where productivity is rising, doesn't lead to substantial wage gains for workers. I mean, it's great that working people are finally getting something like a 2% increase in median wages right now, but we're talking about decades and decades of workers' wages falling behind and the share of economic output, what we create, the wealth that we create, going to corporate profits as opposed to worker wages.
Okay,
that's not lefty claptrap, Sly. That's just what the facts tell us.
Lefty claptrap.
Well, look, far be it from me to you know, accuse anyone of that, but I may myself have been accused of laying down some lefty claptrap from time to time.
Oh, Rick Essenberg from the Wisconsin Institute for Law and Liberty has accused me of lefty claptrap many times. I know he's one of your faves. I know he's one of your faves.
Oh yeah, I love Will. They do really fine work. Really, really tremendous people over there. This is an era where our labor law doesn't work. We've got the proof in the pudding, but you know, anyone who's thought about this for more than 5 seconds, I think, could give you a good explanation because they say, look, this labor law was written for an economy that doesn't look like it does today. And with the explosion of service sector work, where standards are set on the level of a sector, standards are set on the level of a regional labor market, not just union to employer or worker to employer or, you know, a few big employers in an industry nationwide. We're going to end up with this situation where standards are pushed further down. And so our organization is an attempt to build a new form of labor organization, a new form of worker organization, creating new mechanisms to exercise bargaining power. Our wages ain't going up, Sly, because we don't have the bargaining power in the market, whether it's with one individual employer or across all employers.
What's interesting, to put this in the context of the stock market, which isn't the economy, many people think it is, it's not, but it is interesting that Wall Street started pointing fingers at wages going up and inflation for the downturn in the stock market. And I thought to myself, you know, that's nice. Think about that. You get a little bit of a wage increase, and then suddenly there's a major sell-off in the stock market, and they attribute it to that little bit of raise you get, and then you take it into the shorts on your 401k. It seems like you can't win.
Well, it just demonstrates how bonkers the system is right now.
The other thing is, and I pay a lot, I pan for gold all the time, and I listen to a lot of news radio, WBBM in Chicago, and they have these, they have the Noontime Business Report, and I hear these experts come on, and I see this in the New York Times and Washington Post as well. Experts are perplexed on why wages aren't going up. They literally say they're perplexed on why wages aren't going up. Now, do you think that's just willful ignorance, or is it that the media pays no attention to workers' issues anymore, that there literally is an ignorance among educated people?
Do I have to choose between those?
You don't think...
Can it be both?
Maybe it is.
Well, and it's not just that there's a media that doesn't really talk about worker issues, present company excluded from that failure. Obviously, like, you're one of the only voices that actually pays attention to this, and I just want to tell you that I appreciate that. Your listeners appreciate it. We wouldn't be where we are in terms of having a fight back here in Wisconsin without your voice. And this is obviously a week that we can reflect back upon what that means. So I want to say thank you for being the notable exception to a media that doesn't think and talk about the needs of working people. But I also think it's just a fundamental mismatch in values here. You know, these so-called experts, and I'm sure your fingers were up in the air making the scare quotes around experts when you said
mm-hmm.
They don't share the values of the 80% of us who work for a living. I think they have begun to delude themselves into thinking that, well, you know, if we just continue to grow the economy, that'll somehow work for working people. And the truth is all the growth, all the new wealth that's created, and certainly over the last 40 years, has gone to the 1%, the boss class. And, you know, again, not lefty claptrap. This is just hard-nosed, clear-eyed analysis here. The bargaining power of working people has been systematically stripped away from us, not by accident, not by magic, not some, you know, mythological thing arising from, parts unknown, but through a deliberate project to break down the power of workers, because in fact, we did start to build a real middle class and expand the access of that middle class to more and more people, women, people of color, etc., when working people had power and we were building more of it. And so the bosses decided to take that away from us. And as they broke down the power of working people, they assaulted our unions and the laws that pushed up standards, wage floors, for example, they started to accumulate more of the wealth that we create through our work. And to talk about that requires that you talk about power. I mean, obviously. The only explanation that's really legitimate in accounting for all things, and there's certainly other factors. I don't want to say that I don't believe there are other factors at play here. But the one constant is that as workers' power has been eroded, employers, bosses, and the 1% have gotten more and more and more and more of the wealth that we create. This isn't, like, perplexing to ordinary, everyday people because we live it on the job. We live it when we bring home our paycheck and figure out how to pay the bills every week, every month. And I just think that this is a moment here where, you know, we're seeing that the emperor in the establishment has no clothes. And the things that they've been telling us are so transparently false that folks are looking around for other explanations, other answers, and they're looking around here for other strategies.
Excuse me, are you talking about Donald Trump and his tidy whities chasing Stormy Daniels? Is that what you were referring to?
As a solution to our economic woes?
No, you just said the emperor has no clothes. And immediately, Stormy Daniels came into my vision. I don't know why.
That may just be a difference between you and me, Sly.
Okay. All right, stand by. We'll talk more with Peter Rickman right here at SlysOffice.com, brought to you by the United Steelworkers.
I want to thank all the labor unions here in Dane County that help keep SlysOffice.com up and going so you keep up to date, whether it be the Madison Firefighters, Local 311, or the Madison Teamsters, Local 695, or our friends at Madison Teachers Incorporated. These are some of the most active local unions who organize, and constantly stand up for workers. Thank you from SlysOffice.com.
We're back with Peter Rickman, SlysOffice.com, brought to you by the United Steelworkers and great sponsors like Jeff's Guitar Clinic and Fort Atkinson. All right, Peter, I want to talk to you a little bit about, you know, what's going on in Wisconsin with the number of laws that have been passed to literally take local control away from communities on wages. And what has happened in communities around the country that have raised the minimum wage and the fight for 15. I heard Rush Limbaugh, who I know, you're a ditto head. I mean, I know you have his...
Big fan.
Big fan. I heard him go into a real screed a couple weeks ago on how these minimum wage laws are costing jobs. And, you know, he obviously cherry-picked some data and was talking about, you know, employers that are saying they're hiring fewer people, or there's the old, they're going to automate, right? We've got not only outsourcing, but we've got automation, and they'll just hire fewer workers, or they're closing their businesses. I mean, he made it sound like Armageddon. Objectively, you look at the communities and states that have raised their minimum wage. How do you think it's going?
Well, I don't need to give you an opinion, Sly, because people far smarter than you and me have studied this. People with, like, actual degrees and letters after their name that make them fancy doctors and such. Mm-hmm. They've looked at this, and there was a survey of research report put out about a week and a half ago by this was done by some real leading lights in the field. A fellow by the name of Andrzej Dube looked at what's happened in communities that raise wages. And the truth is, there's not some sort of job-killing employment cratering. The truth is, when you raise wages, wages go up. Employment doesn't, you know, drop. The survey of research looked at decades, reams of this, and came to this conclusion. And I think one of the things that was so important about this is that in many ways it reacted to one paper that was done about the Seattle minimum wage law, the first of the real 15 laws that was passed. And, you know, the right got all hot in the shorts about this survey coming out maybe a year or so ago saying, oh, my gosh, in Seattle, when they set everybody on a path to 15, employment in these jobs cratered, and, you know, the service and hospitality things. And the truth of the matter was, you know, the methodology for the survey was so flawed that it couldn't even be published in a peer-reviewed journal. And what made that methodology so flawed, and not that I want to talk about research design here on the air with you, Sly, but it gets to the question you're asking. They didn't allow for studying of the new employment that was created in higher wage jobs to count, and they only their design definition was that low wage jobs below the old minimum wage going away because wage levels just happened to be pushed up further. The minimum floor was going up higher. I mean, that's the definition of a wage law. That those employment losses, so to speak, the disappearance of those jobs because they were converted into higher wage jobs, that counted as an employment loss. So the only way the right can really get at this when they want to talk about raising wages kills jobs is using flawed survey design and then hyping it up on places like Rush Limbaugh, these propaganda outlets. And look, you and I mean, like, I'm not that old. You're not really old, Sly, but you've been around to see this enough that when bosses can automate, they're going to automate. And they do it at some point in time when the capital cost becomes inexpensive enough. And, yeah, there's going to be automation of jobs in the service industry, just like there have been automation of jobs across the board. And that's going to happen. The problem isn't automation. It's who benefits from it. And right now, bosses benefit from it entirely, as opposed to the working people whose jobs are displaced or who work in new jobs that are created as a result of differing technology.
But are you concerned about it? I saw a story about, you know, these new Amazon grocery stores where you can walk in, put stuff in your cart, and literally walk out without seeing a clerk, right? Not even self-checkout. I mean, I'm talking about no one, right? Now, Amazon claims that they're just putting the workers in different positions and stocking and that sort of thing. I don't really believe them. But regardless, I was really disturbed by some of the things I heard some young people saying. I didn't have to talk to someone. I didn't have to deal with someone. And I think of what's happened to the banking industry, where branches are closing, where, you know, people are literally don't understand the value of having human connectivity with a worker. And I know that maybe that seems a little, maybe I'm being a little Pollyannish, but aren't you a little concerned about that whole attitude, you know, that millennials have as far as human interaction?
Well, speaking on behalf of my people here, millennials, look, that's a product of the
aren't
isolation.
You a Gen Xer? Wouldn't you
no,
count
I'm
as
a
Gen?
Millennial.
Are you a millennial? Okay.
Yeah.
Okay.
I'm scraping the edge.
Uh-huh.
Millennial. This is a product, Sly, of the isolation and individualization that we experience, and the anti-communitarian sentiment, the anti, like, solidarity, I'll even use it in the lowercase s form, that is produced in this era of rapacious capitalism. And we just have to recognize that this form of capitalism that we're living under is dehumanizing, and it changes us. It changes our relationship to one another. If we're constantly bombarded with messages that we have to compete with one another, well, then, of course, we're going to start to look at human beings differently. And I think that social flavor that you're talking about is a product of that. But if we're talking about the employment impacts of things like that, I think the real question is, what are we doing about the jobs that exist today and will exist tomorrow? Yeah, I'm concerned that, you know, horse and buggy whip maintenance technicians have lost a tremendous number of jobs since the 1860s. However, I think it's far more important that we look at what's happening today, for example, in the massive distribution services network that underpins Amazon's business model. I think it's really critical that we examine what's going on in home health care services and in hospitals with caregivers. You know, there's tons of jobs that exist today and will exist tomorrow that pay dreadfully low wages. And we got to focus on how we can transform these jobs on the sectoral level, on the industry level, with new forms of organization, with new policies, etc. There's always going to be technological progress, and it's always going to displace people. And until we build a different system, it's going to have adverse impacts on the lives of working people because the boss controls it. I think our challenge is, how do we deal with what will exist, and how do we reform the system dramatically enough so that when we make technological progress as a species, it actually positively impacts the lives of working people? This is a question of power, Sly, and that's what we need to be focused on. How do we have the right kind of power to make change that impacts our lives and make it better?
You're setting me up for my speech that I give all the time, and that is, there is a void, because Republicans are very, very good at talking about the job creators being benevolent and it being an automatic, natural default for them to have all the power, that's just normal. And they filled the void because Democrats and progressive, even some people that call themselves progressive, never talk about workers' rights and the fact that it's not immoral for workers to have power. and that void has been filled. And I really, as the governor's race proceeds here, I'm really troubled that a number of the candidates that support collective bargaining rights refuse to talk about their importance in the Wisconsin economy.
And they're not articulating any sort of affirmative alternative agenda. But Sly, can I just pause and say, I think you've really eloquently articulated a problem that exists in contemporary politics in a way that I don't think I've ever heard someone else say it quite like that. And I just want to reflect upon that and say, right on, man. Thank you.
Well, I'm a college dropout, but I observe what's happened and why it's happened, and to try to get the political class to pay attention to it with all these consultants, and you know, they only think about the term of an election cycle. I get very frustrated because I think it's doing long-term damage.
Yeah, and also, like, can we just remember that whether you went to college or not, whether you dropped out of college or not, really doesn't matter. There's a ton of smart people who, dropped out of tech school.
Well, I was smart enough in college to know at the bar you got more bang for your buck with malt liquor.
I want to respond to this point that you're making, that in this gubernatorial race, we have not exactly seen candidates come out gangbusters with their plans to raise wages and build worker power. I think that happens to be the fundamental job of the governor, to raise wages, to raise living standards. And there's really two ways to do that. One is to set wage floors, and one is to create mechanisms for workers to exercise bargaining power. And look, let's be honest with one another and with your listeners. Governors in any given state are not going to strengthen the power of workers, but for public employees, and I think that's a topic we should maybe touch on in this auspicious week of anniversaries, the governors and state policymakers aren't going to enhance the power of private sector workers by trying to amplify what federal labor law does, because we live in a constitutional democracy that puts straitjackets on us. And this is one where federal labor law is both the ceiling and the floor, as opposed to just the floor. But I come back to my earlier point, Sly, that the federal labor law that exists today is woefully inadequate and horribly outdated. So I think what we need to hear from governors, candidates now, is what are they going to do with the power that does exist in the state level to rebuild the power of working people in an organized form? Because there's tons of things that can be done on the state level. But it does require that their first point of departure be, yes, it in fact is a rightful place of workers to have an equal voice at a constructed table for making decisions about what's going on in their employment and in their industry and in the economy as a whole.
Well, they might want to start. They might want to start listening to workers. You look at the Fox Valley, and you look at the United Steelworkers. As bad as things are with the paper industry right now, and Walker, I call him Rip Van Walker, was asleep at the switch. The steelworkers fought to keep Appleton coated paper open. They went to court, so that didn't become a scrap heap. And it's not perfect, but it's open, and people are employed. And now they're going to open another machine there that'll employ probably another 150 people. You know,
no kidding.
They went to court, right, to stop that from being sold off and torn apart like Oscar Mayer in Madison. They went to court,
and
they did that.
They were joined by our attorney general, weren't they?
Yeah, right. Niedermeyer? I don't think so. So, you know, people might want to start listening to workers because they're not dumb.
Yeah, and you know, I spent a lot of time around a variety of different workers, actually, from, you know, service and hospitality workers, which obviously is my number one priority right now, building this new form of organization to transform service and hospitality employment in these industries. But I also spend time around public employees and teachers, and time around machinists and tool and die makers, and you know, folks in industry or in working in warehouses. It's just sort of the nature of living in America. Working people, we talk to working people, but we don't see a lot of politicians talking with us. And I guess across the board, folks, no matter what their like level of politicization is or where they land in terms of their own personal politics, they all say we got to get higher wages. And the reason we don't have higher wages is because bosses have power. Now, I'm not going to put it on the man or woman on the street to come up with the elegant policy solution of how to address that. I think there's probably a lot of really smart people who can figure that out. But we do need politicians who identify our interests as theirs. And maybe that's too much to ask to have representatives of the working class running our government. But I'd at least like some politicians to identify our interests as their cause. And that's part of how we built the middle class in this country, was not only workers organizing in the streets and in workplaces, fighting and building our unions, but we also had policymakers who saw this project of raising standards and raising the power of workers as something of a policymaking initiative. Now, I don't think Robert Wagner ever had coal black under his fingernails. I don't think someone like Teddy Kennedy ran around working warehouse jobs in the summertime. But these two fellows, these are just two that came to mind, were pretty good leaders on behalf of the working class and the policymaking.
Well, except for Kennedy, except for Kennedy voting for NAFTA.
Nobody's perfect.
I made the mistake of interviewing him one time, and I just assumed that he had voted against it. He paused.
Ooh, a little awkward here.
Of course, you know, I supported Carter, so we all have our...
I was going to not remind you of that on the air.
I was 15, okay?
Young and dumb.
So let me just put in summation here. It's been 7 years since the fight back after Scott Walker took so many people's rights away, dropped the bomb, and, you know, probably fractured the state for generations in a way that no one else could. And I just want to relay the story that you probably saw me put up on Facebook the other day. I had gone up to Canada and I came back early, obviously, because of what had happened. And I went to the press conference where all the union leaders looked like they were at a wake. And after that press conference was done, I was walking towards State Street and I heard this noise. And I stood at the intersection of, it might have been Dayton and State, something like that. And I suddenly hear, I see a bunch of people coming up the street being led by this guy in a flannel jacket, right? An Elmer Fudd jacket. And I hear this noise, and I didn't know you at this point. I had seen you on TV out in front of the governor's mansion, but I hear this noise, and some cynical person standing next to me, some business guy, I don't know who he was, he said, it's going to take a lot more than that to fight this. This thing's going to be forgotten about in a couple days. And little did I know that march up State Street, I believe you were leading the TAs up State Street, and the Valentines that you delivered to Cullen were a spark. And then the next day, firefighters, you know, joined us as we were standing in front of the Capitol, and each day it grew. That movement against Scott Walker ultimately didn't stop Scott Walker, but it stopped what happened in Wisconsin from happening in some other states, at least temporarily, because other governors didn't want to go through it. So I just want to thank you for standing up when a lot of other people kind of had thrown in the towel.
Well, I appreciate you saying that, Sly. Thank you. I'd just like to note that I'm wearing said Elmer Fudd jacket right now. Awesome. Not literally the same one that I was wearing 7 years ago. I cycle through them every 2 years or so.
Uh-huh.
But, you know, I think that what happened 7 years ago here in Wisconsin, you're exactly right in terms of describing how the uprising here prevented this from happening elsewhere. But we need to be honest with ourselves here as far as labor activists, you know, people left of center who, you know, actually think that workers deserve to have what we were talking about earlier in terms of a little bit of power and influence to impact their working lives. We need to be honest to say that the attacks on the rights of workers are not going to cease. They're going to continue to be amplified, and we've seen that with the Janus case in the Supreme Court to try to turn all of public employment into right to work. And we know...
Yes, Rachel Maddow and Chris Hayes and Chris Matthews, they talk about that every night. Thank you, yeah. MSNBC, for the focus.
The nightly labor update. It's a regular part of it. Where they interview real live working class people to talk about what their lives are like. Yeah, it's my favorite part of cable news. they got the same on Fox now too. The truth is these attacks are going to intensify, and we are going to need to have this upsurge of activity. And I always go back and forth now for the last 7 years in this particular stretch of February. Looking back fondly, because that was one of the most incredible times, certainly in my life, something of which I'm most proud to have been a part of. And it was, fairly magical, but we also didn't win, ultimately. And I think it's important to diagnose the various parts of that and what decisions happen when and why. And I think that it's going to take a massive upsurge on that scale and even larger of workers taking the fight to the bosses and demanding more. And I think if we're fighting to get back what we've lost, then the battle itself, the war itself, is already over. We ain't going to get it.
We have
to fight for more.
Let's record history properly. One, Wisconsin workers were hamstrung. Public workers were hamstrung. They didn't have the right to strike. That would have been a very important tool. Number two, many people who even are on our side have the misnomer that we lost because the Wisconsin citizen were against collective bargaining rights for workers, and it shouldn't have been talked about. Let me just say, for the record, in the campaign that was run by the Democratic candidate running against Scott Walker, it wasn't talked about. It wasn't part of ads. It wasn't part of the message. So let us not blame Scott Walker's victory in that recall on people pushing for collective bargaining rights.
Absolutely.
Peter Rickman.
Yeah, and by the way, I don't think that's just like a particular point of view. I think that's actually just, an accurate description of the facts on the ground.
It is absolutely the facts. And we got to wrap it up. Peter Rickman, Milwaukee Area Service and Hospitality Workers Organization. Thanks for coming to SliceOffice.com, brought to you by the United Steelworkers.
SliceOffice.com.
Thanks a million.
Bye-bye.
We work hard every day. In mills and mines, hospitals and schools, in office buildings, pharmacies and shipyards, factories and forests, in squad cars, ambulances and taxicabs. We do all kinds of jobs in Iowa, Wisconsin, Illinois, and all across the United States and Canada. We build the things that build our country. We do things that keep our country going, support our families and our communities. We have the courage to stand up even when no one else does. We have the strength to fight for what's right, for our families and for yours. We're your friends, your neighbors, your sisters and brothers. We're more than 1 million members strong. We stand in solidarity with workers in every continent on the globe. We're the United Steelworkers Union, and every day we fight for you. Please join our fight. Visit usw.org or like us at facebook.com/steelworkers.